Good morning. I'm speaking with Janet Wheel, a military family member and a lifetime associate member of Veterans for Peace, Climate Crisis and Militarism Project, who writes frequently about the links between militarism and climate disaster, and is also a climate and anti-war activist in groups such as Extinction Rebellion and Code Pink. Welcome to KABU, Janet.
Thank you so much, Lori.
Well, first, Janet, tell us more about the Veterans for Peace, Climate Crisis, and Militarism Project and how you became involved.
Thank you. The Veterans for Peace Climate Crisis and Militarism Project came out of the 2020 Veterans for Peace National Convention, which we had to have on Zoom for the first time that year because of COVID. There was a war in the environment and climate workshop, which was eagerly attended. I was one of them, and out of that grew this national project called Climate Crisis and Militarism to research, educate the public about, and protest the links between militarism, but especially US militarism, and the climate crisis.
And certainly, this is an important project because there's often a lack of attention of environmental groups towards anti-war issues or the price of militarism, both economically, environmentally, and for humans on the planet. And even as the very public figure Greta Thunberg has articulated why it's impossible to work towards an environmentally sustainable future without first working towards peace and addressing the root causes of human rights issues, including the genocide in Gaza, most environmental groups do not make that connection. Do you have any thoughts about why more environmental groups haven't insisted that warfare makes it impossible to make any real progress in addressing climate catastrophe?
Well, circling back to part of your first question, what motivated me to get involved in the Climate Crisis and Militarism Project was that for years I have been baffled, angry, confused, you name it, about the lack of, on the one hand, although there's some of this, anti-war, anti-militarism organizations really examining the impacts of war on the environment and now on the global climate. But even more so, the deafening silence and absence of action from the large environmental and now climate organizations in the United States, which have more money, frankly, than the anti-war and anti-militarism groups to a considerable extent, much more coverage in mainstream media, and many skilled and educated people. So I saw this as a long overdue effort to make those connections and communicate them to the general public, but also specifically to environmentalists and climate activists. And we've had some successes, and I want to get to that later. However, you're asking me the big question, which is why have environmental organizations and now climate organizations evaded what I would see as their responsibility to recognize and oppose the massive environmental harms caused by the US military? I think there's a number of answers to that, and I'd be interested to hear what you think as well, Lori. Here's a few of my attempts at an answer. One is that obviously these organizations were founded for specific other purposes. So, for example, Center for Biological Diversity is very concerned with specific animals and plants that are at risk of extinction or at least at risk of having their populations severely harmed. And that's compelling to them. The Sierra Club started out as a hiking group for basically upper middle class and even wealthy people. And it's expanded into this amazing and somewhat internally democratic organization. And I am a Sierra Club member. So their focus is, of course, on getting people into the outdoors, loving the American outdoors, and so on. And then we could go down the list of the 10 major big green organizations. They all were founded, funded, and had their messaging and action plans set for other things. So asking them to take on the urgent issue of US militarism and its impact on the environment is a major swerve. However, it is also long overdue.
I wonder too, Janet, about the money. You mentioned that these groups were much more well funded than anti-war groups, peace groups, and I wonder to what extent that sort of inclination to bow to the wishes of big donors and to refrain from critiques of capitalism and the military industrial complex, what role that plays in their more careful framing of environmental issues.
I think that is spot on, Lori. And I would say it's not really careful. It's timid and it's dominated, as you say, by big donors, including big foundations, some of which are heavily invested in military corporations. So it's political cowardice and it's also pragmatic. And concerned with keeping the flow of money coming in from foundations and individual big donors. That's not an excuse, however, and it's certainly not an excuse after we have had 24 years and counting of full tilt US bombing, invasion, occupation, funding of proxy wars, funding and arming Israel during a live stream genocide, and the rest of the horrors that have gone on in the past generation now.
Well, let's look at two current conflagrations that the United States is supporting. I mean, you mentioned the genocide in Gaza, but also the war in Ukraine. And both of those have generated more long-term pollution than all the global efforts to conserve and protect the environment combined in the past few years. So tell us about what the mainstream media and both political parties who have been cheerleading for these wars, what they've ignored in terms of the environmental costs.
The mainstream media in this country has, to my knowledge, never gone into the specifics of the environmental and climate harms of the Russia-Ukraine war. That's often called the war in Ukraine, but Ukraine is also a combatant. For the first time ever, the climate impacts of an ongoing war are being closely studied by the Initiative on Greenhouse Gas Accounting of War. And reports have finally been made to the United Nations on these issues during the UN Conference of Parties over the last 2 years. And I'm sure that will continue at COP30 in Brazil in November. So, for example, some months ago, this Initiative on Greenhouse Gas Accounting of War reported that 230 metric tons of CO2 or CO2 equivalent, other very toxic and climate damaging gases have been added to the global atmosphere since the war began in February of 22. This is the equivalent of 120 million gas guzzling automobiles suddenly appearing on planet Earth, and to do nothing except to cause death and destruction. That's the other point of these immense CO2 and other greenhouse gas emissions. Unlike the emissions that are caused by other kinds of industry, by agriculture, education, and so on, these are completely unnecessary and destructive emissions. It's not only the ongoing emissions from war fighting and from the burning of Ukraine's forests, which is so tragic, and other things that are happening now. There will also be many more millions of metric tons of CO2 emitted when Ukraine eventually begins its rebuilding. Again, none of that had to happen if this war had not been provoked and if Russia had not taken the poison bait, so to speak, to have this insane war. I wrote a piece which is on Substack, and it's also going to be published in a collection of articles on these issues by Peace and Planet News, which is the print quarterly publication of Veterans for Peace.
We will link to that piece, Janet, on the Oldmoll website. I think most people don't realize the environmental costs of rebuilding. That seems like such a neutral kind of project, that we're always happy to rebuild war-torn places. And if we look at Gaza, and aside from this live stream genocide that Palestinians have been suffering for almost 2 years, the ongoing bombing campaign of Israel, supported by the United States, on a daily basis, on a piece of land the size of Portland, that kind of long-term pollution from the toxicity of weapons used. Aside from that, people have seen, most people have seen just the utter destruction that's taken place. But we often don't think about the carbon impacts of rebuilding. I mean, rebuilding and road building have some of the largest CO2 impacts on the planet.
Right. And if war is prevented, those homes, roads, hospitals, schools, all those buildings, and in the case of Ukraine, huge nuclear power plants, remain undamaged, or at least not very damaged, not utterly destroyed by war. No war gets an environmental impact statement before it occurs. But if nations had to calculate these impacts before they went to war, I think there would be a loud clamor from their own citizens and from humanity at large. Don't do it. Don't go to war. This is insane. Find other ways to deal with conflict, which you're going to have to do anyway, because every war ends in negotiations. Whenever it's appropriate, I would like to just quote a bit from Denis Kucinich's report, War Dust and Collateral Inhalation, Israel Breathes in Gaza's Dust. This is a first of its kind study in air pollution, including greenhouse gas release from a genocide.
Yeah, do you want to read from that?
Yes, thank you. So, as I'm sure your listeners know, Gaza has for almost 2 years suffered the most intense bombing per capita of anywhere on Earth. And those bombs come from the United States, are loaded on US planes by airmen, and then are delivered to Israel. So we have had absolutely no difficulty in seeing where they come from, and what has been happening to people on the ground, but also the agricultural land, the of course, the infrastructure, the buildings, the roads, the ocean or the sea, the Mediterranean Sea, all of it. So in this report that was done by Denis Kucinich, a name that might be familiar to older listeners, now a retired congressman from Ohio and twice candidate for the Democratic Party nomination for president. It's really an in-depth study based on Department of Defense data, glass temperature data, and consequent emissions, and then the review of wind patterns in the Eastern Mediterranean, starting in Gaza, but then going throughout the region. So the sustained, and now I'm quoting, the sustained bombing of Gaza pulverizes stone, heavy metals, and the human body. The vaporizing of human beings under extreme heat and pressure combines with dust, water vapor, and metallic particles the size of microns, all blasted upwards, aerosolized, wind-driven across borders into Israel and surrounding countries. The unlimited bombing of Gaza has created an unparalleled ecological and biomedical feedback loop. Israel, in bombing neighboring Gaza, is breathing in its own fallout, along with the vaporized remains of its declared enemies. So, of course, this is extremely harmful to human health. Breathing in these aerosols hurts the human immune system, and it can lead to neurodegenerative disease. So, of course, the worst impacts are directly in Gaza, where Palestinians who've been bombed, if they survive, are not only breathing all this in, but have their entire bodies, sometimes their hair and skin, completely covered. And this is the most damaging, of course, to children. We've all seen those horrifying photos of children who have turned dark gray because so much of what is described in this article is covering their skin as a sort of second toxic skin. That we've seen many horrific images of corpses, of people bleeding, horrible amputations, and so on. However, many of the dead are never identified because the bombing is so direct on them, or also some of the bombs are so toxic that their bodies are vaporized. Anyway, this is an extremely grim report, and I encourage people to read it. I also want to say that as we're talking about these very grim and even gruesome things, we're not doing it just to wring our hands and say, ain't it awful? We are doing it, and I'm sure this inspired Denis Kucinich as well, so that people wake up, take action, and refuse to accept this as normal or in any way part of war that has always been with us.
And that kind of description reminds us just how beyond belief, how horrific, how soulless this horrific genocide has been. And in addition, to not wringing our hands and becoming stirred to take action, what have you learned after decades of being an anti-war and pro-peace advocate?
I really appreciate that question. There's so many things, but I would say the thing that comes first to mind is that in opposing any given war or armed conflict, people need to take a much stronger stand much earlier and look closely at what the material, the economic interests driving any given war, or in this case, genocide, are. and not be pulled into talking about so and so's a bad dictator, or is Hamas is they're a bunch of terrorists, or other things that are really ultimately just distractions from the main issues and that are highly sensationalistic and emotional. I think we have to be tougher. We have to get ourselves organized more quickly. The other thing I would say is that obviously by now, I think we can all see that opposing one war at a time or one weapon system at a time, such as drones, is not effective and does not reach the American public in the way that needs to happen. We need to be for diplomacy and rational relationships with other countries in the world, and also articulate and defend legitimate American interests in the world, and not be swayed by name calling, by emotional appeals, and by the stereotypes of various countries and peoples. So I'll give you an example. The United States foreign policy in the entire Middle East is now controlled by a foreign government, that of Netanyahu. This is an unbelievably dangerous, stupid, and unacceptable consequence of the "we love Israel and Israel is our strong and only ally in the Middle East" propaganda that has been going on for decades. And that is part of what has led to this horror now unfolding in Gaza and to a lesser extent, but still terrible, in the West Bank, in southern Lebanon, in western Syria, in Iran, and in Yemen.
Well,
We know.
Janet Weil, thanks so much for joining us today. And we'll link to the Veterans for Peace Climate Crisis and Militarism Project and some of your writings on the Old Mole Variety website at KBOO. And thanks so much for your advocacy and your activism in the struggle to end war for all time.
Thank you, Lori.